This morning we're back in John chapter 5, we read verses 8 and 9. Last time we were in James, he was calling for patience. Patience until the coming of the Lord. For after Jesus comes, there will be no more need to endure anything. There will be no more need for patience. Because there will be nothing evil, no trials, no troubles to deal with. And James gives the example of a farmer. And after planting, he waits for the harvest, the precious fruit of the earth. In the same way, the Lord is waiting for the last of His elect to come in. And as the farmer is patient, he knows he will have a crop and a harvest. And so James tells us, you also be patient. And then he tells us to establish our hearts. Verse 8, be also patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh, or is at hand. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Stability and patience, they go hand in hand. Staying balanced is a mark of maturity. We can call that stability, if you will. Stability. It's not really a flashy gift, it seems. In those charismatic churches around us that want to speak about these gifts of language or even babbling or whatever it is that they want to put under that category. And they look at healing and other such things and miss that stability is one of the greatest gifts of God's grace. It's one of the greatest gifts that we can have as we walk through this world. It's interesting. The Corinthians, who are so big on gifts, spiritual gifts, they never boasted about one being more stable than the other. People don't dance around about being stable, but faith will produce in us a peace, a restful spirit, not easily shaken. Now, I know we have to take personality into account. Some people are given by their own nature and personality to be a little more high-strung, perhaps, than others, and more reactive than others. But even the most eruptive can, over time, be less so by the grace of God. Remember what the Lord said in John chapter 14, and verse 1, "Let not your heart be troubled. Believe in God. Believe also in me." Believe in God. This is the key to stability. Believe in God. That's the key. Not just that God exists, but in who He is. The great and only God. The ruler of the earth. The sovereign God who works all things after the counsel of His will. The all-knowing God, the God of all wisdom, as we sing God and read God only wise. The loving Father, so much more. That's a good start for these things to know. The greater you know, the greater your stability. Having worked in horse stables as a teenager and having raised horses myself, it's always interesting to see people who get on a horseback for the first time. And how wobbly they are in the saddle. How uncomfortable they look in the saddle. And you can see there's a certain rigidness that comes over their bodies because it's not a normal place to be and you're up high and that sort of thing. But after time, that spookiness that starts at every time a horse moves, you learn to move with the horse. That now you understand that you move along the way the horse is moving. You've matured as a rider. And so we have, when we think about God and our own stability, we know that an anxious heart is an unstable, impatient heart. And you can tell a lot by the stability of someone's heart by the last couple of days. If people are running around with tears in their eyes saying, "Oh, the worst thing that could ever happen has happened. And woe is me, the end is near, and how tragic this must be," have taken their eyes off of God and have been looking at man for their salvation. And every time you do that, it's like taking a rotten stick and saying, "This is going to be my cane." You'll fall each time. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draweth nigh, is at hand. This is the second mention by James in this chapter of the coming of the Lord. In verse 7, it says, "Be patient, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord." Verse 8, "Be ye also patient, establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand, draw it nigh." Verse 9, "The judge is standing at the door." It's often asked, and I think it's a good question. It's worth asking it. The phrase, what does it mean, draweth nigh, or what does it mean, at hand? What does it mean that the Lord is at hand, the coming of the Lord is at hand? Well, let me give you as simple a definition of that as we can give. Bring it down into this small sentence understanding, if you will. And it is this: that the next great event on the divine calendar is the return of Christ. The next great event on the divine calendar is the return of Christ. That's what it means. The coming of the Lord is at hand. That's the next thing that's going to happen in redemptive history. The coming of the Lord. The word is used commonly in the New Testament. It's funny how some like to take it and run only way. And this word means only one thing. In 2 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 6, Paul said, "I was comforted by the coming of Titus." Same word being used here in 2 Corinthians that James is using. In Philippians 1 and verse 26, Paul would speak of his own coming again to the Philippians. So the word then, it speaks of an expected event. An expected event. In fact, we could easily use the word arrival. The arrival of the Lord. For it will be the Lord's personal presence with His people. When it comes to the arrival of the Lord, what is our major source of information? It's the Lord Himself. In one single chapter, say Matthew 24, He told us many things. In verse 27 of Matthew 24, He told us that His arrival would be first vivid and visual, like lightning in the sky, unmistakable. In verse 36, He told us that it would come at a time that absolutely no one can predict, that no one expected or predicted. In fact, He would further press that point. In verses 40 and 42, "There'll be two in the field, one shall be taken, the other left. Two women shall be grinding the mill, one shall be taken, and the other left." So verse 42, "Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come." You don't know it. And again, just in case, There's some hard heads that were saying, yeah, but we can figure it out. Again, in verse 44, therefore be ye also ready, for in such an hour as ye think not, the Son of Man cometh. And yet, over and over, year after year, there's someone, I've got to figure it out. I worked out this formula. I worked out this equation. And there's three or four times there, Jesus said, no one knows. No one knows. And some people say, what does it mean, though, that he said not even the Son of Man knows? Jesus in his humanity didn't know. In his divinity, of course he did. But in his humanity, that was not given for him to know. It was not given for him to spread to his disciples. Jesus said it's something that will also bring about a separation. He shall send his angels, verse 31, with a great sound of a trumpet. There goes the secret. And they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to another. And then he talks about, as we just read in verses 40 and 41, about two being in the field and one being taken. And if we turn back to chapter 13 of Matthew, which I think gives us a key to understanding what he was saying in Matthew 24 and in verse 31. In Matthew 13 and verse 40, and as therefore the tares are gathered and burned in the fire, so shall it be at the end of this world. The Son of Man shall send forth his angels, and they shall gather out of his kingdom all things that offend, and them which do iniquity, and shall cast them into a furnace of fire, and there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. Then shall the righteous shine forth as the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Who has ears to hear, let him hear. Now there are many other things besides these three things that are said concerning the return, especially said by Jesus. But then by all who would write in the New Testament, by Paul, by James, by Peter, all have many things to write concerning this. In fact, John Blanchard has said that there are about 300 references in the New Testament to the return of Christ. 300 references in the New Testament. If you work that out, that means basically one out of 13 verses in the New Testament has something to say about the return of Christ. That's a lot. What does that tell us? Maybe it should be something that's in the forefront of our minds. And James points to it. And we can understand why then. It's something we should know. Something we should understand. Something that should be in the forefront of our minds. For unbelievers, of course, it's a matter of scoffing. It's a matter of doubt. It's a matter of jokes. But to believers, it's a sure hope. As Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And if I go and prepare a place for you, I'll come again and receive you to myself. That where I am, there you may be also. And notice what he said. If it were not true, I wouldn't tell you. Where I am, there will you also be. This sure hope provides a strong motivation and a call to endure. It's interesting that here we have James that mentions it three times about the return of Christ. And yet, he never explains it. He doesn't go into any kind of long explanation about the return of Christ. No discussion about it. All he writes is the Lord is coming. Which means this. He assumes then that the readers of this letter will already know what he's referring to. It's worth seeing that in many ways, Peter and James and Paul all agree with the effect of the arrival of the Lord, Paul tells us that we should comfort one another with these words. James tells us they should give us hope and stability and stir us up. And Peter, in 2 Peter chapter 3, in verse 10, he tells us, but the day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in the which the heavens shall pass away with a great noise, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat, and the earth also and the works that are therein shall be burned up. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night. That means unexpected. No one knows when the thief's going to show up. But it's not going to be secret, because he come with a great noise. Even the most soundest of sleepers will hear the noise of the Lord's return. Seeing then that all these things shall be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you be in all holy conversation, behavior, and godliness, looking for and hasting unto the coming of the day of God, wherein the heavens, being on fire, shall be dissolved, and the elements shall melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to his promise, look for a new heavens and a new earth, wherein dwelleth righteousness. No matter what's going to happen at that point, he says, this is something to look forward to. This is a great event. This should give us great peace and comfort in knowing this. It should affect our conduct, our behavior. Not just in striving for obedience, but also in our outlook. In that daily, as he writes, looking for and hastening the coming of the day of God. And so also James gives two basic areas that should affect us when it comes to the return of the Lord. First would be this: to establish our hearts, that stability and maturity that we have previously referred to. And then, here in verse 9, do not grumble against one another. The King James has grudge not, holding on to ills, hurts. Grumble. Do not grumble against one another. Isn't it interesting that here we have James once again returning to the use of the tongue? Paul writes in Philippians 2 and verse 14, do all things without complaining and disputing, that you may become blameless and harmless children of God. Some of you may have siblings that were fairly close to your age, and maybe you went on trips with your parents and you sat in the back seat. And as the trip progressed, in the middle of the trip, the beginning of the trip, everything's fine. But the closer you get to the destination that you're going to, and the questions start asked, are we there yet? And that impatience that causes a brother and a sister to start jabbing each other or teasing each other, and that escalates, and the father generally says, don't make me pull this car over. And it seems, as we get closer and closer to the return of the Lord, his church seems to be full of squabbles. The church is like the little children in the back seat after hours of driving. But Paul reminds us in Galatians 5 and verse 15, but if you bite and devour one another, beware, lest you be consumed by one another. What is James telling us? What can we get this down to here? What's the smallest bite that we can get from this? When he says, do not grumble against one another, brethren. Lest ye be condemned, by the way. He's saying this. We'll put it into the modern vernacular. Don't be triggered. Don't be triggered. That's the common buzzword today, that someone says something immediately, it causes this overdone reaction by whomever's hearing it that seems to be offended by it. Don't tell me that Jesus reigns in the midst of this because you don't know my story. Well, you know what? You know where your story comes from? The providence of God. That's where your story comes from. Well, you know, Christianity is full of theology by white men. That triggers me. You know one of the greatest theologians of all time? St. Augustine. Bishop of North Africa. You can draw the rest as to what. I don't think he was bright white. But he was very bright. Everybody running around looking for something. Not everybody, but a good majority of people running around looking for something that offends them. You're not driving an electric vehicle? Well, you must hate everybody. And you must hate the environment. Well, maybe I know that producing the batteries for the electric vehicles causes as much environmental damage as burning petroleum. But that's what James is saying. Don't be like that. Don't be so easily triggered. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. You see, we have to think on this. The return of Christ may still be in the distant future, yet at the same time, He is not far away. The return of Christ may be in the distant future, but at the same time, He is not far away. Be not grieved with one another or ask for vengeance. You may be looking, seeking for judgment to fall on someone, but the judge may end up judging you. The true judge, the perfect judge, is at the door. You don't need to fill his vacancy because there is none. He's here. We're not to set ourselves up as too good to suffer injury or insult. And I've found that over time, people seem to almost invent what someone said and change it around to mean something exactly opposite of what they were saying. The funny thing is, the more we speak, the greater opportunity to offend there is. As Proverbs tells us, in the multitude of words, there wanteth not sin. But you know what's funny? In this eagerly triggered time, we can also offend by too few words. What are you, ignoring me? I'm not worth your time. Such is the state of things in this world. We must be ready to pass by offenses. Things that we might initially find offensive. We must refrain from being quarrelsome. Yes, we can groan when evil torments us. But when it comes to those who are in the Lord's church, we must remember this. There is no one who does not offend at some time. And more times than not, it's unintentionally offensive, but brethren, we're not looking to give occasions for grumbling. We're looking to remove them. And there's something else in the midst of all that that we have to be careful of when there's grumbling going on. Who are the great grumblers in Scripture? The ones who had received such a great gift from God. They had been in over 400 years under Egyptian bondage. They're set free by a miraculous work of God. They're brought over across the Red Sea in the midst of dry land. They're on the other side. They're on their way to the land that God had promised them. Everything's so great, but there are a few things that they're not comfortable with. So what do? They grumble. The Lord wants us to die. Moses, you brought us out here to kill us. But the thing that we have to watch out for, grumbling can be against the providence of God, God's providence. Grumbling also because our case hasn't been taken care of, that God might be unjust or forgetful of us. And so we are told to remember the judge is at the door. The judge of the whole world. The judge who is privy to the secret grumblings and envious groans of men. He's at the door. And he tells us himself. This is where Revelation 3 and verse 20 comes in. It's not about evangelism. It's about a church that thinks they don't need him. That's why he's addressing what? The church of Laodicea. He's not speaking to the random man on the street. Where's the door? Not the heart of man, the door to the church. And he says, I stand at the door and knock. It's up to the church then to say, yes, we realize we need the Lord Jesus Christ. And so he addresses the church, a church that was unaware of their condition. He says, you think you're rich, but you're so poor. What does that tell us? He's present in his churches. He knows the condition of every single church of his. And he's told us that, as he did to the seven churches, that they could easily lose the truth. He said, I will take away your lampstand. So he walks among his church and he knows what it is they think and what it is they feel. So then, as we come to the end of this, what are some applications? What are the things that we take from this? First, patience. Patience means long-tempered. Someone who is not easily irritated or diverted. It's a result of faith. Patience is a funny thing. We can be impatient with some things. It's like if you put your bread in the toaster and you push the lever down and it pops back up. You do it again, it pops back up, and you push it real hard the third time. Toaster, you got one job. Why are you messing up on the one thing that you're made to do? Patience. Someone not easily irritated or diverted. It's a result of faith and is forged in the heat of trials and bolstered by the knowledge that the Lord's return, all wrongs will be righted. The second thing we must pull in, stability is the fruit of maturity. A toddler's first steps are anything but stable. But in time, the muscles of the legs start to develop and the steps become more sure because they're getting older and stronger. Stability is a gift. It's a work of grace. It comes from knowing God. And we have to ask ourselves, be real, be sincere when you ask yourself, how much is it in your heart that you desire to know more of God? Sure, stability is not seen as spectacular or sensational, but it's sure nice to be around those who are. It's so necessary. It's so practical. Seek to establish your hearts. Make use of the grace given. Third, the coming of the Lord is at hand. The next great event on the divine calendar, the arrival of the Lord. Not going to be secret, it's going to be vivid and visual. But you don't need to keep craning your neck to look up. But at the same time, it should not be an infrequent thought. It's our trust and our confidence that He will appear and He will recompense evil. In Psalm 91 and verse 8, looking towards that event, only with your eyes shall you look and see the reward, the recompense of the wicked. Fourth, it's really quick, real short. Stop being triggered, especially by your brethren. And then fifth and last, the judge is at the door. Again, though the return may be in the distant future, there still is a nearness with Christ. He is the judge, the perfect judge, the judge of which it will never be said, you got it wrong. Let's stand together for prayer.